everybody. Welcome to Bad Grammar. This is our first new podcast after being away for quite a while. I'm delighted to be here with Mr. Harold Holt. Harold, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty good.
All right. Glad to hear. People, just about anybody I think that would actually be listening to this is going to know that, Harold, you've been a regular at the Bad Grammar Reading Series, which kind of took over for and will now be living in peace with the Bad Grammar podcast for a while. And I think that you've actually, since we did the shift over to Powell's, I think, have you missed any of them since you first, like, I think you've like arrived at like the second one, I think, and since then.
Yeah, I don't think I've missed any yet. I haven't missed any yet.
I may have beat you for attendance just by being in attendance at the first one.
Just by being the host, right?
Yeah, and I think that Mike Pincus has missed like a couple since then, even though he was at that one. But other than that, so first up, let me just publicly say thank you so much for it. I really do appreciate it, and it's just a huge pleasure to hear the story you've been working on unfurl. And the way that this usually goes is I sort of say where it is that I know you from. And I first heard you read at Twilight Tales, when Twilight Tales still was Twilight Tales.
That's right.
A very, very long time ago. And it was a story about a guy living in an office that I thinks, not living in an office, but working at an office that thinks that the paper shredder is telling him to kill.
That's right. That's right.
And that was just one of those things where it was the, that stood in my memory definitely as one of those just sort of like, you know, because I mean, if you attend these things pretty often, you hear lots of wonderful stories and many of them are kind of alike, and that one just kind of popped.
Absolutely.
And from there, I was lucky enough to run into you again at Jude Meyer's shop.
Absolutely.
I was looking for, you know, new people, just because the reading series had just kind of changed venues, and it was
that was when it changed, wasn't it?
That was right when it shifted over, yeah, because you were never over at Pilsen,
right?
I don't think,
right?
Yeah, so this was right when, you know, we gave up the Action Dome, sadly and tragically, and we headed over to Powell's Books, which has been a wonderful home. And that's about, I'm trying to think what else I know as far as I know that you were, was it a Columbia graduate or was
Columbia
graduate
College.
Which probably explains all kinds of connections and things like that. You know, we're doing Twilight Tales for a long time, and that's kind of that's how I know you, and that's about as far afield in as I am.
Yeah.
Did you find out about Twilight Tales originally through Columbia or just through a friend or
originally I found out about Twilight Tales through Columbia. There was a poster up on one of their billions of bulletin boards, and I took it down and I held on to it for a long time, and I kept saying, "Oh, I gotta make one of these. I gotta make one of these. Gotta make one of these." And eventually, I started coming and you know, enjoyed it, and you know, from there on in, I continued to attend until I believe we lost our venue, we lost the Red Lion Pub, and Twilight Tales started to move around. And it seemed like it got to the point where we didn't know where it was going to be. And some of the locations were a little more difficult for me to get to. And then I stopped going.
Yeah. It's amazing how important that, like, when I switched venues, I thought, okay, I'll maybe lose a couple of people. And it was almost not a complete turnover, but basically every time you switch, you're, like, not quite starting over. You get to keep, like, maybe 25% of the people that were coming before. Just because of that.
Right.
And like Twilight Tales, I mean, when you were sort of getting going with it, I only really was involved with Twilight Tales in the last like little bit.
Okay.
So
you probably came right before it started to
shift
and
exactly
go through changes.
Yeah. Right. And it used to be, I mean, when Tina was, I mean, it was like a weekly thing just with tons of upkeep and tons of people involved with it and lots of,
I was never that involved with it as far as I know that there were a crew of people that kind of did a lot of steady work with it, but I was never a part of that, so I've heard some stories.
I've heard a couple different versions of a couple different things at this point, but yeah. I know that with one of the things you mentioned is that, I mean, when Bad Grammar got going, there was at least a little bit of an impetus to. Was it to start the thing that you've been, the story that you've, the long novel that you've been reading, or was it just to sort of pick it back up again, or?
It was, the idea was that I wanted to pick my writing back up. I hadn't written in a couple years. I kept starting on things and not finishing them, and like I said, all this time went by when I just wasn't writing at all. You know, just a lot of, you know, day-to-day things, going back and forth to work, dealing with day-to-day issues that come up, and it just kind of becomes a distraction to your creative side.
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed to me that the only way I was going to write was to give myself kind of a reason to write. Mm-hmm. And so I started looking for a writing group, and then kind of like as I was in the beginning stages of doing that, that's about when I ran into you, and you were like, "Oh, we got this writing group going here," and you know, you gave me a pitch, and I'm like, "Okay, I'll have to check it out." You know, I mean, it was the location was very good for me. I mean, I don't have any problem at all getting there.
Yeah.
To Powell's Books, so no, it's been working out great.
Was it like that? I mean, obviously, if you went to Columbia just for the writing program there, I mean, mm-hmm. you had at some points. I mean, like, it wasn't the very first time it ever crossed your mind where it's, okay, I'm going to take this seriously, you know, write this much. When, like, with Twilight Tales, was it a similar kind of a thing, or was that more you were already working and were looking for a place to, to share it?
With Twilight Tales, I was already working. I was already writing regularly. And, yeah, I wanted a, you know, looking for a venue to share it, a way to get more work out there. So, and also it helped me to generate more, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yeah, no, the Twilight Tales worked out great with me for that. So, I mean, I realized that as writers, you know, I mean, we kind of, it's up to us to continue doing this as individuals if this is what we're going to do, if this is what we're going to commit to. But it definitely helps to kind of have something in the background to kind of, you know, kick you in your butt a little bit. And it's like, okay, you know, got to get up and write, got to do this. I mean, we you know, we need that. We have to do that. I mean, so many other things out here can just take your attention away, and it's just important to keep that creative side going. It's so easy, and I'm astonished at how easy it is to lose that. You know, like they say, you know, use it or lose it. I'm astonished at how easy it is to lose that.
I mean, it's just that getting that balance right. I mean, I've heard people say, like, in a very kind of heartfelt, I mean, like, I don't think they're kidding. I don't think that they're, like, just talking. How, like, well, like, writing isn't something you can possibly do just by yourself. And, like, I'm always a little bit hesitant about that, where it's just like, well, that's mostly, I mean, the core of it is...
mostly how you write.
The core of it is you sit down, you know? I mean, you know, if you're not sitting, that's it. But at the same time, I mean, like, that, I mean, having... It is a tough thing to sort of, like, have, like, enough outside contact just to sort of, like... Because it is a motivating thing just to be able to have some...
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, if you wait for, you know, waiting for short stories to get published, I mean, you'll go crazy or you'll become...
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, just having the experience of sort of like, okay, they liked that. I could tell.
Right, right. It's absolutely. And also it's just, I mean, to share... It's one thing to share your work with, I don't know, let's just say a casual listener who's not a writer. Mm-hmm. But it's another thing to share your work with other writers. Because it's... the feedback you get is a lot more, you know, it's a lot more critical in the sense of, you know, from one writer to another, you know, here's one thing that was working for me and here's one thing that might work better, you know, for you or, you know, I mean, that's just a good source of critical feedback. I mean, you know, that can't be beat. You know, that can't be beat. I mean, in a writer, we need to hear that. As writers, we need to have other, you know, writer mirrors that we can kind of, you know, put our, you know, hold our work.
Even just seeing somebody, I mean, like, taking down that little invisible thing where it's like, I mean, you maybe sort of imagine what somebody might be like from reading their work, but you don't know. And just sort of having that reinforced that, like... all kinds of different things can come from all kinds of different places.
Right. Oh,
you know,
yeah.
Or even just seeing how somebody reads it, you know. I mean,
that's
it can tell you so much about how they, so.
That is true as well.
Yeah. So, anyway, again, it's just a hugely valuable thing to have you, and thank you so much. What led you to, like, Columbia in the first place? I mean, did you start young? Was it a...
Yeah, I went to Columbia straight out of, straight after graduating high school. I went to Bowen High School.
Were you already, did you consider yourself, like, a writer at that point? I mean, were you working on things?
I'd been writing since I was in grammar school. I was the kid who sat in school in third grade, fourth grade, and made up stories about, you know, the $6 million man versus Wonder Woman, you know, Wonder Woman versus the Bionic Woman, just sitting there, writing stuff to basically to thrill everybody or entertain people. And it was entertaining to me as well. I mean, it was just something I liked, I liked doing. I realized early on that I liked doing it. And definitely in high school, I really got going. Nobody knows, well, only people who knew me in high school know this about me. I used to write this character in high school called the Dark Angel. And he was basically kind of my teenage high school. This was way pre-Buffy. Teenage high school version of, I don't know if you remember Carl Kolchak and the Night Stalker.
I did, I'm 70s. Familiar. Yeah, I've seen some of the reruns of.
I love that show. And so my character, the Dark Angel, he was a writer for the school newspaper. And in every adventure, he got, caught up with something supernatural or, something horrible that he ended up having to deal with, and it was pretty, stereotypical. I mean, no one ever believed him, he was always the only person. He wanted to get the truth out there and he wanted to write these stories, but of course they wouldn't publish his little stories and can't put this in the school newspaper. Right. What's the matter with you?
So it was already leaning towards him on the kind of the horror side.
Exactly.
From the jump, pretty much.
Exactly. Like, so that has always been my interest. So.
Sure.
And I still have all those stories. One of the projects that I tried to start recently, and I didn't get back to it, was rewriting one of those Dark Angel stories. But, turning him into a whole nother character. But just kind of lifting that plot and kind of trying to overlay it with.
Just that same kind of...
Right.
Sort of kind of trying to recapture, okay, this was what I was interested in.
Exactly.
About this. And then...
Exactly.
But with sort of the more... more knowledge and kind of like the more awareness that you have now.
More knowledge, bring more awareness to it now. And I will probably get back to it at some point. But I made my character a gym teacher. And there was just a whole lot of research and, subplotting that needed to go along with that I just wasn't quite ready to delve into yet. So that's why I kind of put it on the back burner. I'll get back to it eventually.
Sure. Do you do with the subplotting and things, are you talking about, like, research? Is it like, I made this guy a gym teacher, I gotta go find a gym teacher I can talk to about X, Y, and Z?
Well, just looking at the types of things that, as a gym teacher, he would be involved in the school. Some gym teachers do a lot of volunteer work. Some of them are on committees of some kind. Some of them have a very authoritative position in planning certain events for the school, especially if they're athletic events. So just things like that kind of
an unspoken thing where it's like, I don't know if you've worked in a school before, but
I've worked in a school.
I
used to teach English.
I had no idea. Oh my goodness.
Yeah,
okay.
I used to teach English over at Julian High School.
Okay, all right. I taught
for 2 years there.
Okay, well, similar, you've probably heard this one where, going from gym teacher to administration is something that sounds funny to people, but until you actually,
do it,
I had no idea. I didn't know you used to teach high school. Oh, my goodness. Was that straight out of school, or?
No, that was after I'd been out for a while. Once I graduated, I started working as a tutor while I was still a student at Columbia. Okay. And I continued to be a tutor even after I graduated. When I left Columbia, I started tutoring at Harold Washington College.
Okay.
So I was tutoring there for, I think, a couple years, before they asked me to start teaching an adult ed class.
Okay.
And so I began teaching adult ed English at Harold Washington. And I did that for about 3.5 years, maybe. And it was from there that I went through the Teachers for Chicago program, and I started teaching at Percy.
So was that one of those things where you just had to teach all day and do night class all night, kind of for
pretty much. So it was pretty exhausting there at one point. Yeah,
that's. I mean, we're talking about things that can take you away from writing for a little while.
Right.
You know?
Right. Absolutely.
That'll do the trick pretty
well.
Well,
yeah, and in the midst, I got married in there somewhere, so. That was in the year 2001, and
so
I
was right this around when Twilight Tales was happening, or before, or after?
It was right around the time. It was during Twilight Tales because I think I I'm trying to remember. Yeah, I think I was already attending Twilight Tales when I met my, you know, when I met my soon-to-be wife. I was already attending Twilight Tales.
Okay.
So, yeah.
So all that was happening at the
same time. All that was kind of happening at the same
time.
That's
a fair bit. Jeez. Well, if you don't mind my asking, mm-hmm. I mean, how did you, was that at all, I mean, I'm just speaking again just because mm-hmm. I was teaching for like 5 years, and then it kind of got to the point where it's like, you know, I'm teaching a lot more and writing a lot less and what I want to be doing. I mean, was that at all a factor in your leaving teaching, or was it something else? Or,
left teaching because high school kids were just, they're a whole different breed of high school kids today, and it was... Mm-hmm.
It was pretty
rough over there. I wasn't expecting that, especially coming from since I taught the adult ed courses, you know, at Harold Washington. Quite a few of the students, I mean, you know, people think adult ed, and you're thinking like these, you know, older middle aged people who are returning to school, but that wasn't necessarily
20,
the case.
21.
Yeah, 20s, 21. So I mean, so they were fairly, you know, fairly young, and mm-hmm. you know, so. I went from that thinking that high school would be at least somewhat like that and just got blown away. I was like, oh, God, I couldn't, you know, I just the
so
amount of
time. So much happens
time,
from like even 15 to 18,
yeah.
I mean, let alone as
yeah,
far as
so
like,
much happens.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, and it didn't seem like that when I was 15 or 18. It didn't seem like that much changed for me, but, you know,
yeah,
it's something. So, no, I just got kind of tired out, and I'm like, yeah, I can't concentrate on anything with this.
Jeez, like my first, not quite my first, but like the teaching experience that made me feel like, okay, yeah, I'll go, you know, south side of Chicago, fine,
mm-hmm.
was when I was at a job as like a GED tutor at a maximum security prison for teenage girls. And I don't know if I ever told you that story. And after having done that for a while, I was just thinking like, okay, I'm overqualified at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So surely I can just go to some random high school. So I said, it'll be fine. Nope.
It puts you in a whole other. Yeah.
You know, it's
crazy.
And I like to think I, you know, didn't get completely swamped and I adjusted mm-hmm. to it, but it definitely wasn't. Some small part of me definitely thought that it was just sort of like, okay, I've seen all there is to see at this point now.
Right. Right. Just when you think you've seen it all. Yeah. Work in high school or work in a high school. And I hate to say that because I hate to, you know, give our high schools a bad name, but it definitely takes a special type of
You can't
person
expect it
too.
To be easy at
yeah.
all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You cannot expect it to be easy.
And so, you can't really balance it with even like a regular personal life, let alone if you're trying to like
have
some kind of a creative life.
It can be pretty consuming. It can definitely consume you.
Sure.
Yep.
Were you, I mean, this isn't even just limited to that, but even mm-hmm. just going backwards from that, it sounded like in school, when you're writing stories and you're presenting things to people, I mean, this was something that was kind of known about you, or that this was...
Yeah, a lot of people, they knew about my stories, and they were like, you know, oh, when are you going to write the next Dark Angel story? I want to be in one. Put me in one as a character, you know?
Yeah.
And I'd write them in there as a character,
sure.
You know? You know, so that was always... Yeah, that was a lot of fun, but I mean, that's when, you know, I mean, at that point, I mean, the ideas just, you know, came to me so quickly and clearly, and... yeah, it was definitely a passion, and I think that's where I'm at right now with my life is trying to is reconnecting with that passion, that mm-hmm. desire to do it. I mean, I never completely lost the desire to write. I think I just, you know, like I said, just distractions here and there kind of, you know, pulled my mind away from it. But I'd always had ideas in my head. I'm like, man, this would make a good story. You know, this would make a good scene. And sometimes I would scribble down things, you know, mm-hmm. scribble down notes, just things that popped into my head. But it was just a matter of finding the discipline again to drag myself to that seat and turn on the keyboard and sit down and actually start composing something.
Yeah, it's like, I mean, people... I think what I'm trying to lead around to, I guess, is because I've been thinking about this so much. I mean, I've been pretty recently, I mean, I'm trying to get in the habit of like when people ask me what I do for, I mean, if they ask me how I make money, then I got to be a little more specific.
Right,
and it's
right,
like, okay,
right.
Well, there's a little of this and a little of that.
Have my day job.
Yeah, but if people are asking me, well, what do you do? Just to say, well, I'm a writer. And then to learn to explain that and sort of let that sit and sort of deal with the... You know, the many interesting expressions that can be on a person's face when you tell them that.
Oh, yeah.
Like, has that been, like, I don't know, like when you were teaching or just doing other things, have you always, has that been an issue?
It hasn't, that part of it has not been a big issue for me, thank goodness. I mean, of course, there's always a couple people. Yeah, I've encountered a couple people who, you know, if I said that, they didn't take it too seriously. And, you know, you could tell they didn't take it too seriously, like, oh, whatever. But, you know, I guess because I've pretty much always had a regular day job, you know, thank God, thank God. Since I've pretty much already, you know, always had a day job, I could always say, well, yeah, you know, I spend a lot of my time, you know, at night writing or whatever, on weekends I'm writing. So it didn't sound like, you know, oh, I gave up my day job so I could write. And so I guess I always kind of had that as a buffer. But yeah, I mean, there were people who didn't, you know, didn't take it seriously.
Even
and
with,
I could
like,
tell.
In terms of like subject matter, I mean, do people know like the kind of stuff that you write? Have you ever had to worry about like, I mean, just again for myself, I'm amazed that I get away with it. I mean, sort of people, one of those things
as
where
far
it's
as
like,
writing horror,
as far, yeah, as far as writing horror stuff, where it's like, okay, you write that in your own name and you put this is, you know, things on the internet, and aren't you ever? And obviously, I don't know about any jobs I didn't get because of that. But
well,
it's never been. Yeah.
I don't know that, I mean, whenever I've mentioned, yeah, you know, I write horror stories or I write horror, again, I don't think I've ever seen an out-and-out, like, you know, negative reaction to it. But, ironically enough, of the published pieces that I have, I think only two of them are horror. So,
what kind of stuff
go
tended,
figure.
Yeah. What kind of stuff has tended to get published? I mean, is there any...
Just like slice of life stories. I've actually got my stuff sitting here. So, yeah,
okay.
Basically
yeah.
like slice of life stories, relationship stories. You know, stories involving maybe a relationship, a dating situation or something like that.
Okay.
That that seems to have gone over better than...
Publishing-wise.
Yeah,
at least.
Publishing-wise.
Yeah.
Better than most of the horror that I've submitted.
Okay, that's
so that's pretty
and
funny.
Always hard to tell. Also,
yeah.
Like I mean,
yeah.
I think I heard I don't want to confuse Lawrence Block. Lawrence Block, he wrote the like the Hitman series and all that. Am I thinking? If I'm connecting it to the right, I'm worried I'm getting the wrong name.
Okay.
It came out in pretty recent years that one of the things that he did to make money for a long time was he wrote. Lesbian erotica under a woman's name of these sort of like more sort of like emotional and sort of romance driven kind of, I mean, by all accounts, I mean, his pen name was very well regarded in the field and he was very sort of good at it. And it was just like, you know, it's what he did to make a little bit of, he didn't disown, I mean, when it was sort of found out, I mean, he didn't run for the hills or anything. It was just sort of like, no, this is another thing that I happen to do. And it's all from the same place. You know what I mean? Like,
Once
you have the skill set,
you
can do that.
No, and I imagine that probably quite a bit of that goes on. I mean, I've heard of a lot of people who,
not specifically that, but,
in different forms.
That's
right.
A dramatic example, but,
No, I've heard some writers or different types of writers. I've heard there are comic book writers who I've heard say, comic books were something that I was just doing just to kind of, you know, kill time and blah, blah, blah until I could write that novel. But it's like,
and
now you're known as this comic book writer. You know, you're known as, you know, the guy who created this character, you know.
Do you think, I think this kind of goes into something else I kind of wanted to ask you about. Like, one thing that has really struck me about the piece, sort of, if you've read a bad grammar, is that lots of times I've definitely found myself stopping for a second and thinking, like, I'm not inclined to think of sort of rules. You know, I mean, usually I'm a very, like, sacred cows are the best hamburger kind of guy regarding, like, the kind of work that I'm doing. So I don't usually come across lots of stuff where it's just sort of like, I didn't know you could do it. Usually it's like,
okay.
There's a few different things, but one really dramatic example when you first started coming to Bad Grammar is the novel that you've been sharing. The main character is a guy who's an inmate, who's a prison inmate, and the one of the things that he talks about very early on is that he's been getting raped regularly.
Exactly.
And it isn't even in a, like, you know, I was looking at the razor thinking about cutting my... It wasn't, like... It was just in a very matter-of-fact kind of way. It wasn't even the first thing that you learned about him. And then when he said it, obviously he was not pleased with the situation. But it was like, okay, this is where I am and sort of moving on from there. And I can think of a few other times when sort of stuff like that happens where it's like, I mean, where it's like, that would feel like, you know, that would feel like one of those speed bumps where most people would stop for a second, slow the car, mm-hmm. ease over, and then they would speed up again, where it's just sort of like, no, this is the lives that they're in. Like, what was the connection between that and what we were talking about? But the, I think, just that the, I mean, when you're thinking about what it is that you wish to write, I mean, some mm-hmm. of the time, I mean, sort of like the fascination with horror stuff in there and some of the, like, sort of that connection between, okay, on one hand, you have, you know, the supernatural investigator or whatever trope you want to bring into, and then on the other hand, you have, like, sort of more realistic, kind of more, you know, adult that you stuff that you probably were not writing about in sixth grade. Probably,
right.
Maybe, I don't know, tell me now.
Right.
But, like, you know,
no, you're right. You're
reconciling
absolutely right.
Those things. Like, when you're thinking about what you want to write.
I mean, I think as a younger, I mean, I would assume that as, you know, as younger writers, when we were younger or when I was younger, you know, obviously the, you know, the stereotype images or the caricatures kind of jumped out at you easily because that's what you saw all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, for
you
me,
know,
it was just...
You want to do another one like that.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, it was just, that was what I saw all the time. There was always this story about the guy who believes this thing that nobody else believes, and he's seen something nobody else has seen, and, you know, so that was always the thing. Writing as an adult or as I do now, I mean, I like the idea of my stories having very real characters in them or characters that you could imagine. A character that you could imagine existing and take this guy seriously. You can like you said, oh, he's in prison and, you know, he's been raped. You know, I mean,
this guy isn't off the shelf from like Scream, you know.
Exactly.
Like
exactly.
Whatever genre kind of thing.
Right.
Yeah.
This is a very real guy and a very real situation. And I like to take those very real earthy situations and then throw something just a little offbeat in there.
Yeah.
I like to do that because I want my characters believable. I want the reader to buy into the fact that, yes, this guy exists, and yes, this just happened to him. And now this is happening to him. You know, I mean, I think that's important.
It just increases the impact so much where it's like, it's not sort of like, okay, here's a person who exists so that a monster can surprise him and we're all kind of waiting to see what the monster looks like. It's like, no, this person actually had things going on before this even happened.
Exactly. Yeah. So, no, that's definitely the kind of plot or the kind of setting that I like to bring to my stories when I write mm-hmm. them. So I do want real characters, real situations, and then you throw the paranormal in there and kind of mm-hmm. see what happens.
Do you consciously do like research for things like that? I mean, is it more a matter of just sort of like, by the time you want to write about it, you find, I mean, I've found it both mm-hmm. ways, where sometimes where it's like, if there's something specific, I've told myself, I mean, you know, like I wrote a novel set in something not unlike the prison where I was working, even though the whole time I was there, I was always telling myself, okay, I'm not here doing field research or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, I'm working, this is not part of the writing part of my life. And then once you let it sit for a minute, you sort of go back to it, then it's like, okay, I have all I need. And then other things, I mean, I've gone out and specifically found just because it's like, okay, mm-hmm. if I don't talk to somebody, then I'm just going to repeat things I've seen on television and it's not going to work. I mean, I don't know what kind of approach you take.
And I think it depends. Like you said, it kind of depends on what the plot is. I mean, there are some things that I would have to talk to somebody or I would have to research to kind of get a better sense of things. I mean, even with the story that I'm writing now, yeah, I do plan on doing some more research on prisons
mm-hmm.
and just, you know, on certain aspects of prisons. I mean, I've done a little just so I could, you know, crank out the, you know, the story as it's been coming out.
Yeah.
But no, there definitely are things that I do want to research more thoroughly. Mm-hmm. There are things in the story that I want to tighten up. I mean, obviously what you're getting now from the piece that I've been reading is pretty much as it's spilling out of my head. So
Which frustrates to me, like, to no end, by the way, because I really like the things that where it's like, that was the first draft. God damn it. You know, like, I just really it's you know, it is upsetting to me. But you know,
I will withdraw the compliment out
sure,
of that.
I could, the compliment is there, and mm-hmm. it's just the, first draft. Sure, fix it up. No, I'm sure you can make that better. You know, like that.
I mean, well, you know, and that's an interesting thing, too, because, I mean, I can see areas where the story needs to be tightened up, and I can see gaps that I need to fill.
If I read it all as one big thing, I bet I bet it would seem more. I bet I would see some of those things just as far as the structure of the whole thing,
right.
Even just like line by line. I mean, was there anything in particular that brought you around to the subject in the first place? I mean, was it an old idea? Was it something where it's like,
I think I recently read an excerpt of, I can't even remember what it was. I recently read an excerpt of I cannot remember the name of anything, but it was an excerpt from a novel, and the excerpt featured a prison inmate who I believe was on death row or something, and I think he had actually like killed somebody or something like that. And I guess something about that just kind of took my attention. And I saw a way that I could write a character like that. And a way that I could make this guy likable to the readers. The character in the excerpt that I read was not a likable character. I don't know, since it was just an excerpt, I don't know if we were supposed to like this character or if maybe we grew to like him later. I don't know. But I definitely wanted my character to be someone like.
You saw an opportunity there.
So
where it's
So
what if you did it like this kind
exactly.
of kind of thing?
Exactly.
Okay.
And I also thought it would just be kind of interesting to have something, you know, again, bringing horror into a situation like you're in prison. Here's a prison. We're kind of locked in here. I did whatever it is I did. Now I'm in here. Oh, but guess what? Now this is happening. There's a succubus going around.
You know, another story, somebody might spend the whole story doing everything they possibly could to avoid, and then you start there, and then then you make it worse. So
yeah, no, I saw it as an interesting situation, and I wanted to see what I could do with that situation, so I started writing it. And as I've told you and some of the bad grammar people, my initial idea was that this would be a story that would be about 12, maybe 15 pages. So
it's
it's well gone past that. I think I'm on page 98 or something. So I did not see the story growing in the way that it has grown.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and there's still things, as I said, you know, those, some of those things that I want to tighten up are things that I want to add, that I want to incorporate into the story. A couple other subplots here and there I want to get more into. So, yeah, there's definitely a lot more meat there than I initially saw.
Okay. All right. I know that tonight you're not going to read you're not going to be reading from that novel. You're going to be reading something else. Do you just want to hit us with it fresh, or do you want to introduce it at all?
I will be reading a short story tonight, which deals with another one of those realistic characters. He's a pimp, and he encounters the devil.
Okay. All right. I'm just going to stop this just for a second so we can make sure everything's working okay, and we can hear that story in just a moment. All right, we're back. Take it away, Harold.
Thank you. This is called Bedamned. I met the devil on my 21st birthday. It was 1977. I had just returned to Chicago from the north suburbs with my best money maker, Trina. Trina had a classic hourglass shape, and she was tall and sexy, 5'8". That was tall for a woman back then, not like today where every 3 out of 5 are built like Venus and Serena. Trina had a glowing skin, long, full-bodied curl, and the kind of model's face you'd see in a hair care magazine. The environment and fucked up family dynamics made me a pimp at 17, and finding Trina at a Southside warehouse party was one of the best things that happened to me. She was freelance when I met her, but I offered her protection if she became one of my girls, and she knew I wasn't on no bullshit. They knew me on the Southside. I was tight with GD Nation, Blackstones, and even the Latin Unknowns at that time. I could have a crew of hardcore humbugs move in on anyone with just a word. My uncle, they called him Papa Dog, had a little escort business on the low end of Rockford. He had this high-quality client who wasn't interested in no cheap hoes who would rock it in the back seat for $10. He didn't want no runaways or junkies that half-assed a blowjob just to get to that next fix. This client wanted young and tight eye candy that knew how to put the freak on a brother. That's where my girl Trina came in. Trina drank a little, but she kept that shit under control and didn't do drugs. And she spent most of her money looking good. I had to shoot my best game to get her on my team. And when that didn't work, I gave her the LD special, my own style of lovemaking. I sexed her up, then went down on her, showed her what it was like to live the high life way before Miller ever slapped that name on their beer. See, all she knew was studs who jumped on top and tried to bang her brains out, or the ones who talked shit while they screwed, calling her every kind of whore and dirty bitch they could think of. She had never had a man go slow and savor each stroke or take the time to see that she got something out of it. She'd never been made love to, only boned. I never touched her again after that first time. I had a business to run. I wasn't trying to get caught up on no trick-ass snatch. But sometimes, with other women, I did find myself putting Trina's face on their bodies. So anyway, Trina had just turned 18. I sent her out to my uncle's in a limo. She ended up spending 5 business days with my uncle's client. But the dude was paying crazy loot, and even with my uncle only breaking me off 35% for a lender's fee, there was plenty of loot to go around. I kicked it on up to Rockford to fetch Trina and pick up my money in person. My uncle had a heroin side hustle, and I wasn't taking no chances on him screwing me over or him getting Trina hooked on that poison. When we got back to Chicago, we hit 47th Street. I had to make some collections, and Trina wanted to get her hair done. We were staying at a motel on St. Lawrence, but I had decided that we'd rent an apartment I'd seen on 48th and Vincennes. Trina liked that idea. I just wanted to keep her happy, so she'd keep making me money. I had a gray Cutlass sedan with its own personalized parking space behind the new apartment I was renting. But I preferred to make my local rounds on foot. For business to stay tight, people had to see my face. They had to know that I could be up in that ass in a split second if shit wasn't right. As Trina and I walked down 47th Street, all the usual business was going on. Drunks hanging outside the liquor store, guys shooting dice all up and down the streets, couples walking hand in hand toward the lake, afros with fist-handled picks all around, thugs parked on the curb, their car radios bumping, their hoochie-coochie girls sitting cross-legged on the hoods of their cars. As we approached the 2 neighborhood motels, the other working girls stood around in their miniskirts and tight shorts. A lot of these women were in their late 20s or early 30s. They rolled their eyes at Trina when we walked past. After all, Trina had taken a lot of their regulars. Girls were always trying to fight her just for a chance to scratch up her face and ruin her looks. Trina could take care of herself, but I would usually step in to keep her from getting hurt. We got to the 3rd-degree motel and went to our room up on the 5th floor. I told Trina to gather our things together since it would be our last night sleeping there. I went in the bathroom to wash my face, and when I came out, Trina was standing there in nothing but hot pink satin panties with a small gift-wrapped box in her hand. "Happy birthday, Mickey," she said. I wasn't expecting that. Hell, I hadn't even remembered it was my birthday. But I was 21 that day. The law said I was a motherfucking man now. But I had been a man since I was 15. I took the gift as Trina got on the bed and bent over in front of me. It would have been easy, so easy, to just spank that ass and whisper all that good shit in her ear, stroke it good enough to melt it. But I had shit to do and money to make. I couldn't let myself get caught up like that. I pulled down her panties and gave her right butt cheek a peck. "I'm going to check the other rooms to see if these working girls got my money. Why don't you get an outfit for the night and we'll go to the movies? They got a double feature over at the Hamilton. Mr. Mean with Fred Williamson and Drunken Master with Jackie Chan. You down for that?" Trina rolled over and lay back. She seemed satisfied enough with the idea of going out. She nodded, and I thanked her for the gift. I left and slid the box into my pocket. Down on the 4th floor, I approached room 405. There was no answer when I knocked, so I started pounding against the door like the police. Jacqueline, I know your tricky ass in there. She shouted back at me. Damn it, I'm working now. I got someone in here. I wasn't no fool, so I kicked that door in. My girl Jacqueline was on the bed wearing jeans. Her red blouse hung open, revealing a black bra. She was counting a wad of money and giving some of it to a little girl who sat next to her and couldn't have been any older than 10 or 11. As I rushed Jacqueline, she got up and stood in front of the girl. Wait, Mickey, this is my baby sister. My mama needs some money. I didn't give a shit. I grabbed her throat and tried to shove her treacherous ass right through the fucking wall. And that shook a hanging picture from its hook. With her throat in my grip, Jacqueline gagged, dropping all the money around our feet. Her eyes bugged and watered. I wanted her to be afraid. I wanted her to think I'd kill her so that she'd never steal from me again. Try this shit one more motherfucking time and see what happens. You hear? I let go of her, and she started coughing and crying. As I gathered all my money off the floor, I had forgotten about the little girl standing there, scared shitless. I handed her $2.50s and said, "You go to your mama, and don't you never set foot in a place like this again. You hear?" The child was hesitant, but eventually she nodded, took the money, and left. I turned back to Jacqueline, who was still sobbing, tears of fury, not fright or sadness. I could tell. "How am I supposed to make enough with your new little bitch on the street?" she screamed. I took $6.20s from the wad, crumpled them, and tossed them at her feet, then told her, "If you can't hang, then touch up that resume and go legit. Oh, but wait, you're a high school dropout, right? So what's your plan B?" As Jacqueline glared at me, I stared her down until she finally looked away. If she had had a gun, she would have shot me. If she'd been in a car, she would have run my ass down. If I'd died of a heart attack right then and there, she would have spit on my corpse. She hated me with the utmost passion because I was in control of her life at that moment. I made three other collections from the fourth and third floors before returning to my room to get Trina, who had changed into a tight burgundy leather outfit while I styled and profiled a watermelon suede two-piece. We were ready for a night out on the town. Outside, Trina and I walked westward to where my car was parked. Excuse me. On our way, Trina noticed one of her girlfriends sitting in a parked car next to the curb. "Ooh, there go my girl Pumpkin. Where'd you get your hair done, girl?" Trina walked over and talked shop with her friend while I waited. The guy driving the car stepped out long enough to acknowledge me. We gave one another the proper respect, then he got back inside while I took in the activity up and down the street. Aside from homeless people begging, I noticed that more and more of the peddlers were Vietnam vets, many of them disabled. There was one legless man on a cart in front of a barber shop. His body ended about halfway down his thighs. The bandages that covered his stumps were filthy and gray. He wore a dirty shirt of standard issue camouflage that was open, revealing dark and grimy skin. His face didn't look any better, and his hair was unkempt. It was a bit unsettling to watch this guy, who didn't even look like he should be alive, scoot around on the four-wheeled slab. He had a coffee can for cash donations. Eventually, he noticed me and scooted in my direction. With his grimy left hand, he shoved the donation can toward me and grumbled, "Will you help me? I ain't got nothing, man." I pulled out a $10 bill, but then I stuck it back in my pocket and said, "You never should have fought in that stupid-ass war. See where that dumb shit got you? I got a government letter, too, about a year before that shit ended. What did I do? I stayed right here, made money, and kept all my limbs. Hey, if the greatest boxer of all said fuck it, could the greatest lover of all do any less? You hear me preaching, son?" The legless man peered through me with a glare that may as well have been a spear. Then he scooted back to the barber shop. A moment later, a couple walked toward him, a man with his arm around a woman's waist. The beggar approached the man and asked for a donation. The dude shook his head and kept walking. But then I saw the legless little creep twist his neck in a freakish, unnatural manner. He hocked and spat on the back of the passing man's leg. The man paused and let go of his woman. He turned around slowly and walked back. The bell bottom of the man's pant leg was damaged where I'd seen the legless gimp spit on him. In fact, It looked like I saw smoke coming from the damaged spot, but I figured that was my imagination. The man dropped a wad of change into the donation can. He rejoined his woman and they left. Then the beggar looked up from his cart at me, and I felt like I was staring down the barrel of a loaded shotgun. Trina brought me back to earth. We walked past the beggar, and as we did, I felt a cold patch. It was almost summertime, but there I was trying to shake off a chill. As we approached the next corner, I heard someone running up behind us. I kept a snub-nosed 38 in my jacket pocket. Whirling around and pointing, it was all reflex. The pointy-headed chump behind us stopped and raised his hands in the air nervously. Hold up, man, hold up. Ain't no static. I got a deal for you. I had to ask, what kind of fool are you to be running up on someone like that in this neighborhood? That stupid shit'll get you killed, man. I quickly put away my gun. I sure didn't need the police to drive by and see me waving it. The man was light-skinned, wearing brown leather and a pair of loafers. He didn't look like anyone I'd ever seen. All right, Superfly, speak. What kind of business you got with me? He smiled a lot. I hated motherfuckers who always smiled, especially when they smiled at me. He said, no disrespect, but I got a client who wants a date with your lady. He's willing to pay $5,000 on the spot, right here, right now. Guy smilingly pulled a small paper bag, bound by rubber bands, out of his inside jacket pocket and gave it to me. I undid the rubber bands and looked inside. There were wads of 50s, each wad bound by smaller rubber bands. I could tell just by looking there were probably 5,000 in the bag. You a cop or something? Asked Trina, who was pretty good at spotting cops. She'd been raped by one when she was 16, and she would never forget how a cop looked when he thought his gun and badge gave him power. Guy Smiley swore up and down he was no cop. Like I said, I just got a guy looking for a date, that's all. My car's parked down the street, and I got another 5,000 in the trunk. That's 10,000 altogether. We got a deal? Things that sounded too good to be true usually were. Let's meet your client, I said. The three of us walked back the way we had come. We stopped in front of the barber shop, and Guy Smiley pointed at the legless man on the wheeled slab. The grimy little beggar's eyes looked different than they looked earlier. They were hungry eyes now, insatiable and cruel eyes. It even looked like the hair on his head and face had grown some. Is this a fucking joke? I abruptly handed Guy Smiley's money back to him and said, we don't swing with no kinky, coked-out crap. Trina quickly pulled me to the side and whispered sharply, wait, Mickey, we could do this. Just the money he had in that bag could hook us up for a minute. I wouldn't have to go out for a few days, you know, and you could pay up a few months on the apartment. I couldn't believe what I was hearing. Trina, this ain't about the apartment. I just don't want you alone with that nasty half a motherfucker on the slab. Why, Mickey? What else are we going to do tonight after the movies? Nothing, right? Right? She was actually kind of pissed off. Now understand, I would have slapped Jesus to the floor for raising his voice at me. But I was just glued to the spot with Trina. Kind of surprised, actually. Trina and I agreed to an hour, no more. Back in our room, I counted the money while Trina grabbed condoms. After about 20 minutes, someone knocked at our door. I opened it, and it was the grinning fool again with another paper bag. I took it from him and peeped inside. There was the rest of the money. Come on, my sister, I'll take you down to his room, he said. I intervened. No, just give her the key. She'll go down on her own. You stay your ass here with me. There were no arguments as he handed Trina the key. Before she left, she kissed me on the forehead. I listened until her footsteps descended out of earshot. Then I closed the door. Guy Smiley sat on my bed, that irritating slick-ass grin still on his face. He didn't look like the kind of guy who liked getting his hands dirty. I said to him, if all my money ain't here, I will pistol whip the shit out of your punk ass. He didn't respond. I had to keep eyes in the back of my head to make sure he wasn't trying to clock me from behind. He stayed put while I counted every $50 bill until I reached 10,000 on the head. I got up and approached him. Your guy must have saved up all his military pay. I guess he didn't spend it on no Vietnam trim between firefights, huh? I gave his shoulder a friendly shove, and his grinning head rolled right off his body, and thousands of bugs and maggots filled the opening of his neck. His head lay on the bed with bugs and worms slithering from his eye sockets and his open throat. Then I smelled something burning. When I looked around, all the money on the table had caught on fire, and only the money burned, not the table or the paper bag. Then I heard shuffling behind me, so I spun around again. The headless body with pestilence pouring from its open neck was up and reaching for me with its twitching fingers. I pulled my snub nose and fired twice, but the body kept coming, and bugs crawled from the two holes I'd just created. Its hands grabbed my throat and shoved me against the desk. The grip kept me from breathing. I started to feel numb and dizzy, like I was hanging upside down with all the blood rushing to my head. I still had the gun, so I instinctively fired two more shots at the disgusting head on the bed. Just like that, the hands that had choked me dropped lifelessly beside their host's body. I drop-kicked the headless body in the chest. It broke into pieces when it hit the floor, spraying black bugs and critters everywhere. Trina was suddenly the only thing on my mind. I rushed downstairs to where she was servicing that ungodly thing on the squeaky cart. For the second time that day, I kicked in the door. Trina lay back with her eyes closed, like someone in a coma, but her legs were somehow raised and spread. But there was nothing holding them up that I could see. The bed was burning, just like the money. And the legless man wasn't legless anymore. His legs were tall, hairy, almost goat-like. His head looked more hideous than before, with pointed ears. His tongue was like a serpent's tongue that lashed around its own neck all the way down to its crotch and its ass. Before I could do anything, it climbed on top of Trina's unresponsive form and began thrusting away like a filthy animal in heat. I approached it from behind and fired whatever bullets I had left. The beast growled at me, but it wouldn't stop what it was doing. I tried to grab its shoulders and pull it off of her, but its tongue came out of nowhere and went inside my mouth, down my throat. I felt bile emerging as I grabbed hold and snatched it out of my mouth. Before I could steady myself, the creature kicked back at me with one of its goat legs. It didn't hurt so much, but it sent me flying. I could feel myself unable to touch the ground as I went back. Pain throbbed across the back of my head as well as my lower spine while I went flying through the window. The cold air rushing past me confirmed what my mind had still refused to believe. I was falling to the street, 5 stories below. I don't even remember hitting the ground. I've been wheelchair bound ever since then. I can't feel anything below my navel. I can't piss without a catheter. Can't shit without diapers. I thought about killing myself so many times, but I could never bring myself to do it, not without knowing if there was a chance I could ever see her again. Trina's birthday gift to me was a gold watch with a quartz battery. It was new and innovative at that time, and she'd written a note with it. To a man I'd die for who spends so much time avoiding me, let this gift help you count the moments of time we waste being apart. Only you can stop time from wasting, and when you do, we'll be together. Today, I learned that Trina didn't die that night. She had disappeared and was presumed missing for a while. She turned up in a sanitarium one day and ended up being a resident there for some years until released into the care of her aunt. She did eventually die, and now I sit here at her gravesite. I'm going to leave this tape recording by her tombstone so that her family won't blame her or think she was crazy. They'll know that I led their little girl to the devil. But after today, she won't be there alone. I'm going to let these sleeping pills and this sunset deliver me from my nightmares. Excuse me. I'm going to let these sleeping pills and this sunset deliver me from my nightmares. You see, my watch stopped today. After all those years, no more wasted time, just like Trina said, it's time to be together.
Harold, thank you so much. For anybody that's listening to this that is interested in hearing more about your work, I don't know if there's a way to go about that right now. I mean, aside from attending our wonderful reading series where, you know, you're often to be found. But do you have like an Amazon page, anything like that right now?
I don't have an Amazon page, but my my latest publication, which actually came out in December of 2009, said, with a magazine. It was a short story published in a magazine called The Storyteller Magazine. And if you go to thestorytellermagazine.com, you can request, you know, archived issues, and they do have them available. So so there is that.
Okay, all right. Well, Harold, thank you so very much. And yeah, it looks like we're all up for tonight.
Outstanding.
Bad Grammar is released according to a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial 3.0 Unported License. You can get the new Bad Grammar at iTunes and in the listen section of Brendan Dessner Online the first week of every month. If you'd like to support Bad Grammar, thank you very much. We're good, but we would encourage you, if you're feeling generous, to go ahead and check out www.protect.org to learn more about a cause that we wholeheartedly support. Our theme music is lovingly provided to us by The Gotsicles. You can find out more about The Gotsicles over at www.gotsicles.com. And that is it. Thank you so much for listening, and I will see you here next month.